More cities partner with the feds on immigration. Broward and Palm Beach hold elections with controversial stakes, and a Tamarack triple murder raises red flags. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup. I'm your host, Tim Padgett. In the next hour, we're going to sort fact from fiction, but acknowledge the fear when it comes to the immigration policing agreements several South Florida cities just struck with the Trump administration. We'll also look at the results from important local elections in Broward and Palm Beach counties. Can Deerfield Beach still be great again? And we'll examine how last month's ghastly homicides in Tamarack could affect a new push to revoke Florida's red flag gun law. All that coming up right after the news. I'm Tim Padgett. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Bienvenidos, bienveni, bienvindo. President Trump and Florida Governor Ron DeSantis insist they can compel state and local governments to join their crackdown on undocumented migrants. But under the U.S. Constitution, they cannot. Immigration enforcement is solely a federal responsibility, period. But that doesn't mean state and local governments can't voluntarily collaborate in that effort. And in today's U.S. political climate, especially Florida's political climate, a growing number of cities are deciding now it's better to do that. Even in a region as heavily populated by immigrants and undocumented immigrants as South Florida is. Coral Gables and Hialeah in Miami-Dade County, Davie in Broward, Key West in Monroe. They're among the first municipalities that have agreed to partner with federal immigration and customs enforcement, or ICE. But what does that really mean and not mean? Will it lead to the kind of racial profiling by police critics fear? Or will it just make it easier for the feds to deport migrants who've committed crimes? As always, we'd like to know your thoughts. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now in the studio to help explain what this new facet of the great American immigration crackdown means is WLRN investigative reporter Danny Rivero. Danny, how are you?
Doing great, Tim.
Also with us is Sierra Ortiz Blanes, immigration reporter for our news partner, the Miami Herald and El Nuevo Herald. Thanks for being with us, Sierra.
Thank you for having me, Tim.
And I want to start with you, Sierra, because you've been watching this trend play out here this week in two of Miami-Dade County's largest cities, Coral Gables and Hialeah. From what you've heard, especially in the statements of Coral Gables Mayor Vince Lago and Hialeah Mayor Steve Bovo, what is driving local governments here now to cooperate with the Trump administration on immigration? That is, aside from the fact, as Mayor Bovo, for example, has emphasized, undocumented migrants are, in fact, committing a crime by being in this country illegally. But what is, do you feel, really pushing this?
So just weeks ago, recently, Florida sheriffs announced that all county jails in the state had joined 287G agreements, which are a set of agreements between ICE and local law enforcement agencies to deputize local police with limited immigration functions. So for operators of county jails, law enforcement agencies that operate county jails, this was mandated by state law. But this street level task force thing we're seeing play out in Miami-Dade is different. So while local officials and police chiefs acknowledge that they are not mandated to follow that legislation, they're saying this is just a way to comply with Florida's sanctuary city laws and basically just formalize existing cooperation between the feds and local agencies. But to be clear, for municipalities and towns, nothing explicitly requires this in the law.
But aside from laws, I get the feeling that there's also resource strain factors, as Bovo, for example, has pointed out. How much of this has to do with strains on resources that mayors like Bovo say immigrants are causing their cities here? And how much then has to do with Trump politics?
Well, I think that's something that, we're still trying to suss out as reporters, but what's definitely interesting, like you point out, is that places like Hialeah, majority immigrant, majority Hispanic, where officials have expressed that new arrivals are causing strain on city resources, are doing this. And it does raise questions about how much this is related to city politics, state politics, national politics. For example, Mayor Bobo at the last council meeting where this decision was approved, for him to authorize this agreement, said that, it's a fine line to make a decision like this in a city like this one that has been built by legal immigrants, and this is a quote, a very fine line as opposed to illegal
Yeah,
immigrants.
one of the ironies you point out is that all fi or all the Hialeah City Council members, they're either children of immigrants or are immigrants themselves.
And it's worth noting that many of these new arrivals in Hialeah and South Florida in recent years have come in legally through the Biden-era parole programs or through temporary protected status.
Right.
So that means that they're protected from deportation and have work permits.
But Sarah, as I mentioned at the outset, there was a lot of confusion this week about what local law enforcement will be permitted to do under these so-called 287G agreements. For example, Hialeah Police Chief George Fuentes said there will be a protocol. And under that protocol, Hialeah cops will not be, as he said, weaponized to conduct immigration raids or stop people to ask for their immigration documents. And yet, as you point out in your reporting, the agreement actually does let police pull someone over if they suspect they might be in this country illegally. No, what is the actual protocol?
Correct. So there's a difference between what the agreements, authorize and kind of the scope that police chiefs are saying they're going to be taking on this. So for now, it remains to be seen, how they're going to implement this. They haven't yet identified which officers will be joining the training, but the gist of the 287G program is that, ICE authorizes local police to have immigration enforcement functions, right? So those policies, those police powers vary from model to model. Florida jurisdictions have overwhelmingly joined the task force model. That includes Hialeah and Coral Gables. That model precisely allows cops on routine cop duties to, stop, interrogate, and arrest people they believe are violating immigration laws under ICE's purview.
Okay.
So the police task force models, they also allow state and local police to detain someone without a warrant if they think that person will get away before officials can obtain it.
Okay.
And they also allow local officials to prepare notices to appear, which are the court documents that
Ah, yeah.
initiate deportation proceedings, although ICE has to sign off on those.
Yeah,
So,
that seemed unusual to me when I saw the fine print in that agreement this week. Yeah, I hadn't seen that before.
President Obama actually killed this model over widespread undocumented racial profiling and
Yeah.
concerns of lack of oversight.
Mm-hmm.
President Trump resurrected it last month,
Okay.
and it's clear that Florida is now on the front line of bringing back this model. I think
Okay.
there's been over 100 agreements
Well,
signed.
yeah, thanks for that clarification. Danny Rivera, can you walk us through how we got to this point with local governments and immigration? I mean, this is not entirely new. Local governments like Miami-Dade County have been confronting this pressure to cooperate with the feds since the first Trump administration, but we seem to have arrived at a point where local leaders like Bovo and Lago want us to take as almost a given that municipalities are obligated to do this in spite of the 10th Amendment boundaries I pointed out earlier. So again, Danny, how did we get here?
I have been talking to many people about this, and this kind of partnership with local police for helping the federal government do immigration enforcement, it really started after 9/11. Like, this thing first launched after 9/11. Back then it was, we're going to go after terrorism. And so, the feds were actually hoping that, local law enforcement would jump on it and join up. And some did. Florida was the first place where this kind of model actually first
Oh.
happened, under Governor Jeb Bush,
Jeb Bush,
who was the
right.
brother of the president.
Yeah.
But a lot of places didn't do it. There was a lot of pushback from police departments and police chiefs and sheriffs. They said, "We don't really want to get involved with this because we depend on those communities to call us
Yeah.
and report crimes and
And I
come
want.
together as witnesses and whatnot." So through the process of talking with people, there's been I mean, it's a vibe shift. And
Yeah.
especially here in Florida, it's like there were concerns about this in the past. There's not a lot of concern of that happening. Another big part of this is the state passed a law, an immigration law, last month, signed into law by Governor DeSantis. It has a $250 million pot of money for police departments who participate in this. There's a lot of money on the table. Plus, there's a $1,000 bonus for every officer that goes through the ICE training. So there's a lot of financial incentive for cities to participate in this.
Good to point out. Danny, I want to play a clip of someone you spoke with this week, speaking to what you were talking about earlier. Juan Cuba, a board member of the Miami Freedom Project, a pro-immigration advocacy group, who objects to the agreement his city, Coral Gables, entered into this week because he fears it just makes local police no different now than federal agents.
What's happening right now is the Trump administration is building out their network for mass deportations. And I don't think the city beautiful, city that I live in, where I'm raising my kids, should be part of that system. So we want the city police chief to rescind this agreement with ICE.
So Danny, speaking to what you just mentioned earlier, one of the points we keep hearing from Cuba and other critics of these agreements is that if you turn local cops into federal immigration agents, essentially, you break down a wall that traditionally has helped local law enforcement, especially in terms of building trust and gaining cooperation with local residents. Will a victim of domestic violence, for example, be as willing to seek police help if she fears those same police will check out her immigration status now and arrest her for deportation? What are the pitfalls in that regard?
You know, it's definitely something that I've been hearing repeatedly, this concern about the trust breaking down between police departments, sheriff's offices, and the community. And, you know, it's worth pointing out, it's not totally unfounded. And it's not totally unfounded because this is not the first rodeo. Like, we've been through this. And like I was saying, after 9/11, some departments did do this. One of the most notable ones, and it became a national story at some point, was Maricopa County in Arizona. You had Sheriff Joe Arpaio,
yeah,
who participated in this exact program and started doing huge sweeps in the community. There was widespread, well-documented racial profiling. The government itself found he was widely participating in racial profiling, asking people for papers, trying to deport people. And you know what happened? The crime rates went up. People stopped calling the sheriff's office. Yeah. The violent crime rates shot up. It was not good from a public safety standpoint.
We have Richard on the line from Miami. Richard, welcome to the South Florida Roundup. What are your perspectives on all of this?
Hi, thank you. You know, my feeling is that if the government really wanted to deal with immigration, they would enforce e-verify for everyone. I mean, for all companies of any size.
Right. E-verify being the rule that would compel companies to report that all of their employees are documented legally.
Right. And e-verify has been around for a long time. But the reason they don't do it is because our economy really is dependent on undocumented people to do all sorts of jobs, whether it's factories, farms, huge farms, et cetera. And so we want it both ways. We want cheap labor. We want undocumented people here that we can use for all of those needs that mostly documented people don't want to do.
Right.
But we also want them to be scared. And, yeah, of course, everyone agrees pretty much with the fact that undocumented people that are criminals should be here. That's another story.
Right.
Well, thank you.
No, thanks for that larger perspective, Richard. Sierra Ortiz-Blanes, in your reporting in Coral Gables and Hialeah this week, speaking of all this, what sort of objections and criticisms were you hearing from residents and advocates about these agreements?
Yeah, so residents and advocates in both communities, in Coral Gables, they protested, spoke at the city meeting. In Hialeah, you know, residents actually also spoke at the city meeting, addressing their commissioners directly. And well, they brought up the point that Danny just made about the issue that this will erode community trust towards police and make communities ultimately less safe, make it harder for cops to do their jobs, police officers to do their jobs, if, you know, witnesses and victims are not coming forward, if they fear that they will be detained over their immigration status. Business leaders actually mentioned that this will be bad for business. You know, if workers don't show up and community residents aren't going to their to business places because they're afraid to leave their house. And again, in many cases of these workers, we're talking about people with legal work permits. But ultimately, many of them, including religious leaders, describe these programs as a moral failure because they will, in their view, stoke even more fear that began at the beginning of the Trump administration, now with this mass immigration crackdown in the community.
This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm talking with WLRN's Danny Rivero and the Miami Herald's Sarah Ortiz Blanes about the growing number of Florida and South Florida cities that are now participating and partnering with federal immigration enforcement. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Danny Rivera, I think there's also a lot of constitutional confusion regarding what the state can and can't compel local government to do when it comes to immigration enforcement. As I mentioned, it's pretty clear the federal government, under what's known as the 10th Amendment's commandeering principle, cannot force state and local authorities to assume federal responsibilities like this. But the murkier question, which I think we've watched Governor DeSantis exploit for quite a while, is whether the state can mandate local cooperation on immigration the way, for example, we've seen the state preempt so many local ordinances. What do you think the courts would say about that?
So I'll take it piecemeal, but one thing I do want to dispel a little bit, you know, the governor himself has said in press conferences that cities are required to do this. He said that they are required to do this.
Right.
They are not required
exactly.
to do this. He cites a law that was passed, that he signed into law last month, as having some kind of requirement that was not in the law. That was, the governor wanted that to be the law, but it did not make it. There was a whole pushback from the Florida legislature. It did not make it. So they're not required to do it. You know, it is an interesting question if they can be forced to do it. Every county that...
By the state. Yeah.
Every county that runs a county jail does, under Florida law, have to have an agreement with ICE to help them, you know, to help the federal officials in deportation efforts in the county jails.
And do experts regard that as constitutional?
Well, that's the interesting thing. There was pushback about this when it first happened, but nobody's brought it to court.
Yeah.
It hasn't been litigated on a constitutional basis if you can do this.
Okay.
One could argue maybe the contract is not valued. I mean, it's not a real contract because it's under threat of duress, right? Like they're threatening to kick you from office.
Well, I would imagine we may start to see some litigation then. Sarah Ortiz Blanes, as we mentioned, Coral Gables and Hialeah are not the only South Florida cities to join in cooperation agreements like these with federal immigration authorities. Davie and Broward County, Key West and Monroe County. Why did these municipalities, which admittedly don't experience the immigration strains that Miami-Dade cities like Coral Gables and Hialeah say they do, why do they feel the need to enter into this arrangement as well?
Well, I have not spoken to authorities in these jurisdictions, but some reasons that this might be the case. The first is the financial grants, the financial incentives that Danny mentioned for local police agencies joining these programs. It's also very possible that they're following this trend that's happening across the state. Again, Florida is on the front lines of the systemic implementation of these federal local partnerships. And in the case of the Keys, you know, local police over the years often respond to the arrival of immigrants from Haiti, Cuba, and elsewhere landing on their shores. At times, officials have said that that's overwhelming law enforcement in the area.
Good point.
So it's possible this could be a way to formalize those partnerships to address whenever that strain does happen.
Right. No, very good point. Sarah Ortiz Blanes is the Miami Herald's immigration reporter. Danny Rivero is WLRN's investigative reporter. Many thanks to you both.
Thank you, Tim.
Thank you, Tim.
Still to come, winners and losers in this week's big round of Broward and Palm Beach local elections. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. For Broward and Palm Beach counties, March 11th was a bit of a local Super Tuesday. Almost 20 cities, towns, and villages held elections in places as large as Boynton Beach, population 81,000, and as small as Sea Ranch Lakes, population 552. But there were some important races involved. Boynton Beach chose a new mayor, as did Royal Palm Beach and Deerfield Beach, where the loser in that election had promised to make Deerfield Beach great again. We'll discuss in a minute what might have meant. There were controversies, of course. This is, after all, South Florida, home of the infamous Hanging Chad. In Coconut Creek, a city commission candidate sued another for defamation. In Riviera Beach, voters couldn't elect a new mayor because all the candidates were disqualified. But perhaps the most distressing note was the turnout in Broward County, at less than 10%. It was low enough to qualify for sea level rise mitigation. And that may prompt re-examination of a new state mail-in ballot law. Did you vote this week? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now in the studio to review the results is WLRN's Broward County reporter Carlton Gillespie. Also with us is WLRN's Palm Beach County reporter Wilcom Brutus. Welcome, gentlemen. How are you?
Great, Tim. Hey, great Tim. To be here.
Let's start with the mayoral races. Carlton, you had a big one in Deerfield Beach where Commissioner Todd Drosky defeated a business consultant named Dan Hurst, a conservative who campaigned on a pledge to, quote, make Deerfield Beach great again. What was that all about, and why weren't voters there buying what Hurst was selling, especially in terms of his claims that development in Deerfield Beach is corrupt?
Well, I think this is kind of the crystallization of something we've seen a ton in local politics around here, is the online rabble rouser. And that's what hers was. He had, you know, Facebook groups, and on the Nextdoor app was very popular in you know, protesting almost any move that the commission of Deerfield Beach made. And Drosky, of course, was on that commission. So it became a way of, you know, people who aren't necessarily engaged in local politics can be easily swayed if someone is telling them that everything they're doing is corrupt. It makes people pay, you know, maybe more attention to that. But the reason that it fell flat with voters is because Deerfield Beach is actually doing very well. They have the best bond rating ever. Their millage rate is I think, the lowest it's ever been. So it just kind of, once you peel the layers back, there wasn't a whole lot there to Herz's arguments, but it was.
And if he's using slogans like make Deerfield Beach great again, does that imply that he himself is a member of the MAGA movement, as we call it?
Yeah, he did send out flyers and would title them to, you know, to my fellow patriots and things like that. But again, Tim, this is still Broward. This is still maybe the biggest Democratic stronghold in the state. Yeah. It's not something that's going to play well in Broward.
And as you said, the reason they did buy what Drosky was selling was because, as you said, Broward is doing okay. Right. Or, I'm sorry, Deerfield Beach is doing okay.
Yeah, and I think some of the development, you know, specific items that they went back and forth with were a little controversial, but it's really, you know, in a lot of cases, it's nothing more than NIMBYism, and the apartment complexes can get a little bit of pushback, but they go up and everyone moves on. And I think that's what happened.
Okay. Wilcom Brutus, you had two mayoral contests up there in Palm Beach. The biggest was Boynton Beach, the county's third largest city, where Rebecca Shelton won by a landslide. Who is she, and what are voters hoping she'll bring to the city?
Yeah, she succeeded outgoing Boynton Mayor Tim Pinserga, who was term limited after 3 years. And like Carlton point about Broward doing pretty well, or Deerfield doing pretty well, Palm Beach County is doing pretty well also. Yeah. So Rebecca Shelton is a real estate broker and businesswoman who will have to manage a growing city, essentially, basically balancing economic development and infrastructure projects. The city has been working to improve, or should I say beautify, its Eastern Corridor, which is the entrance of the city, to make it more pedestrian friendly, adding new bike lanes, because there has been some disparities in services and infrastructure, especially in comparison to the western side of town. So she'll have to address those divisions.
And Wilcom, remind us, in general, Palm Beach County has been enjoying a lot of economic development boom vibe in the last year or so, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, of course, you hear the common phrase, the Wall Street South and the city of West Palm Beach,
exactly,
which is our biggest city.
And
obviously, there's pros and cons to that, right? There's gentrification that comes along with it. But it's no denying the fact that you were seeing all sorts of development, including in Boca Raton.
Now, you also had a mayoral election in Royal Palm Beach, Wilcom. What was the result there?
Yeah, so over in the village of Royal Palm Beach, which is in the western side of Palm Beach County, voters elected retired U.S. Army Colonel Colonel Jeff Himera as their new mayor, and he won nearly 60% of the vote, so clearly a landslide here. The election also follows the passing of longtime public leader Fred Penton last year,
right.
And Himera actually served as an acting mayor. Mm-hmm. And so some of the challenges he'll face in Royal Palm Beach is reducing traffic congestion and improving transportation and other infrastructure projects as some of the challenges he'll face. And
that's so, interesting, because we don't often think of traffic congestion in West Palm Beach County,
which is an indication of growth throughout the entire county.
Carlton Gillespie, we also had some noticeable city commissioner races in Broward, starting with Coconut Creek, where, as I mentioned, in one of them, the winner, Jacqueline Raley, felt compelled to sue her opponent, Philippa Sklar, for defamation. How did things get so ugly there?
Well, in the interest of full disclosure, I do have a family member that works for the city of Coconut Creek, so I'll just stick to the facts.
Sure.
This is a long simmering feud between Sklar and Raley, because Raley is the head of the master HOA for the Winmore community. Winmore is about...
HOA means Homeowners Association.
That's right. And it's a homeowners association of about 8,000 properties in Coconut Creek. It's a huge, it's a huge political driver in the city because there's so many people that live there. Raley was the head of its master HOA. And this started 2 years ago over a concrete slab for a barbecue grill.
Uh-huh.
That Sklar thought there was money handed to a contractor improperly. And since then, Sklar has attacked Raley anytime the HOA has pretty much done anything. She started a Facebook group called The People of Winmore Uncensored, where she rabble-roused about Raley's actions and eventually released a two-part documentary that was like 17 minutes each called The Wicked People of Winmore that photoshopped Raley's face on like a weird like bat creature, and also County Vice Mayor Mark Bogan, who is the lawyer for the Winmore HOA. He was also in that video. Sklar started a Kickstarter to, quote, fight condo corruption in South Florida. She's apparently not used any of that money, but Bogan was also part of that lawsuit, the defamation lawsuit, because his name was all over this kind of stuff. So eventually Raley got fed up and sued Sklar for defamation and won, I should say, very handily in that race.
Fascinating how the smallest things can just blow up into these citywide disputes like this. We also had an interesting commissioner contest in Miramar, right? What stood out there for you?
Well, the big thing is that there's a ton of change. You had Alexandra Davis, who was promoted to the county commission. Her seat was up for grabs. And there was another commissioner who had served for 22 years who no longer sought election. So two of the seats were brand new. We're going to be brand new people to the commission. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of a big change for Miramar that's seen a ton of stability there. There's still some old heads in there. Yvette Colburn won against a write-in campaign from Luis Pedraza, and she's been there for a long time. But Miramar was a very stable city, and now they're going to have two new commissioners in a time where a lot of people are critical about how much money the city spends on events and recreation facilities.
It's fascinating, too, how these smaller communities all of a sudden have to grapple with this kind of growth. Wilkin Brutus, let's talk about Riviera Beach. I mean, man, how do you get five candidates disqualified, including all the mayoral hopefuls? Remind us what happened there and what's still going to happen next month when it comes to finding a new mayor.
Yeah, it's a wild story. It's definitely a Florida story for sure. Five candidates in a Riviera Beach mayoral and city council race were removed from the March elections after using debit cards instead of checks to pay their qualifying fees. And it went against election rules, and the decision was made by a panel of judges.
Is that just Palm Beach County election rules or state rules?
It seems like it was city rules, actually.
Oh, just citywide. Okay, all right.
Yeah,
That's a good clarification. Thanks.
Absolutely. And this is extremely unusual because the council now has to appoint a new mayor after this election, and voters won't elect a new one until 2027,
right?
City general election. The appointed mayor will serve a 2-year term instead of the usual 3-year term. And so voters will have a chance to actually elect a mayor, but it'll take some time.
Yeah, 2 years from now.
Yeah. And you know, aside from that, the city did decide on two races, though. Bruce Guyton, a former city council member, edged out the controversial incumbent Trodrick McCoy. And incumbent Shirley Lanier won her third term in another tight race. And these races were tight because the city of Riviera Beach has been going through other controversial issues, such as its water contamination controversies in the past. And so this was a referendum in the eyes of many residents in Riviera Beach.
Okay, so put the debit cards away. All right.
Yeah.
This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with WLRN's Carlton Gillespie and Wilkin Brutus about this week's big and sometimes controversial state slate of local elections in Broward and Palm Beach counties. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. And a reminder that if you miss any part of the program, you can search for the South Florida Roundup podcast in the NPR app or wherever you listen to podcasts. Carlton Gillespie, let's talk about the big elephant in the Broward elections room this week, which would be that depressingly low voter turnout. Now, you point out in your reporting, though, that voter apathy really wasn't the sole culprit here. In fact, let me play a bite here from your interview with Broward County Election Supervisor Joe Scott, where he sort of lays out one of the big problems at play here.
So there's a lot of people out there who probably have no idea there was an election. They got a vote by mail ballot back in November, and they would assume that they would get a vote by mail ballot today or for this election, but they did not because they had to sign up all over again.
So, Carlton, walk us through what Joe Scott is referring to there and why this seemed to end up driving Broward voter turnout down so badly.
Yeah, according to Scott, this is the second election cycle where a state law has been in play. That state law says that at the end of, in the December of every even-numbered year, vote-by-mail ballot requests are canceled and people need to redo them for the upcoming year. So this being so close to the end of an even-numbered year, so many people that aren't aware of this rule have their vote-by-mail requests canceled and don't get their ballots. That's what he's talking about there when he says they probably didn't even know there was an election because they don't know there's an election until a ballot shows up at their house and then they can do their research and vote on it. He said he was expecting this low turnout, but it was...
But as low as 10% or less?
He knew that the impact of this would happen. And again, this is a March election after a presidential election. Turnout is always pretty low.
True.
But he said that he made education efforts in the cities who were holding these holding votes in this election, and they're going to expand that to a larger countywide effort in the summer. But he said it's a serious problem, and he wants the legislature to maybe reconsider that rule.
Yeah, and what was the rationale really behind that law to erase every mail-in ballot every 2 years like that way? What was the reason for that?
Well, we've heard a lot of concerns about mail-in ballots being
abused, yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. So this is a way they figure if we just make everyone do it every 2 years, that way there's no chance that we're getting mail-in ballots sent out to someone who's no longer alive or whatever the case may be. But I don't know how much abuse it's solving, but the real world impact is the low voter turnout.
Right. But as you said, Joe Scott feels that this what happened in Broward this week could be an impetus for the legislature to reconsider this mail-in ballot law.
He's optimistic about it. I think he's optimistic that the legislature will do it. But if not, he said that he is fully prepared to go gung-ho with education efforts because that's the only other thing he can do.
Exactly. Wilkin Brutus, what was turnout like in the Palm Beach County elections? Are elections officials there seeing something of the same phenomenon there because of this law?
Yeah, I don't think so. I think, based on the numbers at least, Palm Beach County saw 13% voter turnout, which is slightly higher than the March 2023 municipal elections, which saw 12%, and 2022 saw 18%. So it's been going up incrementally every year. I think there is a broader educational component that the SOE does pretty well in Palm Beach County.
Supervisor of elections.
And so far there hasn't been any other reporting from other publications that has turned out or has discussed any low turnout. And I haven't seen it in my reporting either.
Okay. Carlton Gillespie, I also mentioned the small village of Sea Ranch Lakes earlier, population 552. The South Florida Roundup's political coverage does not discriminate by size. So what was the election there? And while you're at it, can you remind me where Sea Ranch Lakes is and who lives there?
Yeah, well, I think I should first say I want to congratulate the people of Sea Ranch Lakes because low voter turnout was not an issue in the village. 397 people cast ballots out of 550. That's more than That's what, three-fifths at least.
You're asking an English major, so don't even go there.
But they voted for a council member. That race was won by Denise Bryan. There was a five-person race. Now, the council at Sea Ranch Lakes, doesn't do a whole lot. It's a couple of private homes in a gated community, uh-huh. a private beach club, and a small commercial complex that's most famous for being the first Publix Lionel Messi was spotted at when he came to South Florida.
It's interesting. All right.
But interestingly, Sea Ranch Lakes is owned by the Sea Ranch Lakes Beach Colony. It's privately owned. It's not owned by the city. So they have a gatehouse in front and they can deny, non-residents entry into basically what is a gated community. Mm-hmm. They incorporated back in the 60s to kind of stop potential, being enveloped in either Fort Lauderdale, Lauderdale by the Sea, or Pompano. So
right.
It's a very small private community. And
well, hey, kudos to them for that large turnout. Wilkin Brutus, along those lines, I know there were a total of 12 municipalities in Palm Beach County that held elections. We talked about three of the larger ones earlier, but can you tell us just quickly in the last 30 seconds we have about races in some of the smaller Palm Beach bailiwicks?
Yeah. Lake Park, which is a small town of about 9,000 people, saw some pretty big changes to its commission. Voters there replaced two incumbents while retaining two more commissioners. So even the smaller municipalities were quite active in this election.
Wilkin Brutus is our Palm Beach County reporter. Carlton Gillespie is our Broward County reporter. Many thanks to you both as always.
Thanks, Tim.
Thank you, Tim.
Still to come, a terrible homicide in Tamarack raises red flags, as in our red flag gun laws. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. As homicides go, this was especially ghastly. On February 16th, in Tamarack in Broward County, Nathan Jingles, an Army veteran, allegedly murdered his estranged wife, her father, and a neighbor. He was apparently in a rage over the restraining order his wife had filed after several domestic violence incidents. The triple murder was made ghastlier because the couple's 4-year-old daughter witnessed it all and was abducted by Jingles as he fled the scene, according to police. He has pleaded not guilty. But could the atrocity have been prevented? 8 Broward County Sheriff's deputies have been placed on leave amid an investigation into their handling of the domestic violence. What's more, Jingles was supposed to have surrendered, back in December, the semi-automatic pistol he allegedly used in the murders, which is why this case has become a red flag as Florida considers repealing its red flag law, which allows families or police to temporarily take guns away from people who are deemed a danger. Do you think Florida should revoke its red flag gun law in light of tragedies like Tamarack's? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now is Shira Moulton. She's breaking news reporter for the South Florida Sun-Sentinel, who's done in-depth coverage of this story and its red flag ramifications. Shira, thanks for being with us.
Hi, Tim. Thank you for having me.
I first want to ask you to walk us through this awful triple homicide in Tamarack last month on Sunday, February 16th, when Nathan Jingles allegedly shot and killed his estranged wife, Mary Jingles, who was seeking a divorce, correct?
Yes.
Okay, as well as her father, David Ponzer, and a neighbor, Andrew Farron. Shira, what led up to this and what happened that day?
Yeah, so we all found out about this when an Amber Alert went out that morning, but this had been really a years-long situation. They had been married for several years. They were both in the Army, so they moved here from Germany. And where it sort of begins in court is when Mary first sought an injunction against him a little over a year ago, right before she filed for divorce. And she had written about how he had threatened to kill her if she ever left him, how he controlled like all of her finances. She couldn't go anywhere except for like a nearby park. Just all these horrible things. And then he moved out of the house and they took all of the guns as is part of the domestic violence injunction. Mm-hmm. And then later he got the guns back because that injunction was dismissed. And then she filed for another one most recently in December. And that's where we got a lot of the details of what had been happening leading up to her death. He had made a lot of, disturbing threats through their daughter, and all of these suspicious things had happened. And she had been reporting all of those to the Broward Sheriff's Office.
Yeah, and yet, I want to go back to what you just said earlier, the domestic violence injunctions dismissed. That brings us to, as I mentioned earlier, no fewer than 8 Broward County Sheriff's personnel being placed on leave in the wake of this triple homicide as the county investigates how they all apparently failed to act on the myriad signs of danger here, especially regarding the domestic violence. In fact, Broward County Sheriff Gregory Toney has used the word failures. What were the most crucial ones, do you think?
Yeah, so we're still learning about the extent of what they knew, but we know that they were told by Mary about that he had left this really strange backpack in her garage with like a note about air embolisms and duct tape and restraints. And we know
Shira, can you specify for us what air embolisms? Could you explain that to us?
It's a method of killing someone, which it didn't end up being how he killed her, but we also know, and this is the other major failure, is that he had all of his guns still. And the real big issue with that is that they had taken his guns before, so they knew that he had them, and yet they didn't take them a second time.
Right. So, Shira, when you step back and look at the comprehensive tragedy here, this case would seem to be a showcase of what Florida's red flag gun law, what any state's red flag gun law was created for, as well as the domestic violence injunctions you mentioned earlier. Remind our listeners what the red flag gun law is, how it works, and as you've pointed out in your reporting, how it might differ from the domestic violence measures that were also involved in this case.
Yeah, so our coverage has looked at some of the key distinctions between these two kinds of court orders, because in domestic violence injunctions and in the red flag laws, people are supposed to surrender their guns, but there's a big difference in how they're enforced. So in domestic violence injunctions, like in Mary's case, it's sort of an honor system where they basically leave it up to the person who receives the injunction to surrender their guns. But red flag laws give law enforcement more power. They can serve a search warrant on the person and go into their house and actually seize the guns. And so some people after the whole tragedy have been calling for basically domestic violence cases to use some of those red flag law provisions and in order to actually get those guns out of the person's house.
Now, in Florida, the red flag gun law, though, you are not required to hand the gun over to law enforcement. Technically, you can give it to a family member or some other way of just of getting it out of your hands. Is that correct?
In domestic violence injunction cases, that's what we've been hearing. It seems that they're more lax than red flag laws. And so a lot of people want more similarities between the two, because right now what happens is people will just lie and say they don't have guns, or they'll give them to a friend and then easily, you know, obtain those guns again.
Right. And they don't have to give those guns up permanently under the Florida red flag gun law. It's only for a year, correct?
Right. It can be extended, but a lot of the times they do get their guns back. And that's what we saw in Mary's case. So,
Now, in Nathan Jingles' case, his gun, a semi-automatic Sig Sauer P320 automatic pistol, or semi-automatic pistol, as I mentioned, he should have surrendered that back in December, correct? But he didn't. What happened?
Yeah, we're still trying to learn about exactly what went wrong, but what we know is that the first time he gave up the guns, including that gun, that was when he was moving out of the house. So what we were told is that they actually went into the house and maybe were able to take the guns that way. But the second time, even though they knew he had these guns, it seems like maybe they didn't go into the house or actually physically see the guns, so they didn't take them. But it's definitely something that we're still trying to understand.
Mm-hmm. And Shira, regarding the prosecution of Nathan Jingles himself, as we mentioned, he has pleaded not guilty to the murders. But yesterday, prosecutors apparently filed a significant new motion in the case, right?
Yes. Yeah, so they're filing the notice to seek the death penalty against him. So it's not a huge surprise given all of the allegations, but we're going to have to see what the defense looks like.
Yeah. Do we know? I mean, given what we know, I mean, I have to admit, I was a little surprised that he pleaded not guilty when you look at what's been in the news. But what is has the defense indicated what he might be claiming as if this does go to trial?
His defense attorney and mental health has come up. So it's come up in the prosecutors, their notice. So we're going to have to see how that plays out. I know that I'm not entirely sure, you know, what his mental health history looks like, but that might end up being
okay.
The defense.
That's a good point. Thanks. Yeah, thanks for reminding us of that. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with Shira Moulton of the South Florida Sun Sentinel about the recent triple murder in Tamarack and what it tells us as Florida considers repealing its red flag gun law. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Shira, you and your Sun Sentinel colleague, Angie DeMichel, offered a very insightful report this week about Florida's red flag gun law and how it's actually been working across the state since it was passed. And I should say, not just the red flag gun law, but measures like the domestic violence injunctions, et cetera, that are often involved in these cases. Especially in cases like this. In fact, your story led with another earlier case in Tamarack itself. What would you say were your more important findings, particularly in terms of what may need to be reformed when we address cases like this?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing that we're seeing is that this isn't just an issue of law enforcement. It's the fact that our state laws don't currently place a lot of responsibility on law enforcement to actually go and take these people's guns away. And so what a lot of people, you know, think needs to change is something that looks more like the red flag laws. And that would mean, you know, actually giving law enforcement the power to go into people's homes and taking their guns.
Which Florida's red flag law does not really technically compel law enforcement to do.
Well, domestic violence injunctions don't, but the red flag law does allow search warrants. I mean, it's definitely much more common in those cases for that to happen.
Okay.
So,
can you help us understand then why Florida's red flag law wasn't really incorporated into Broward County Sheriff's law enforcement's procedures in this particular case?
Yeah, I mean, it's something that's come up. And one of the things that, you know, some domestic violence lawyers told me is in these cases, they think that the domestic violence injunction should be enough because they're already supposed to give the guns away. So why issue, you know, the risk protection order under the red flag law? And that is a problem because the guns are actually not being surrendered.
Right. But at the same time, it looks as though Florida Governor Ron DeSantis and his fellow Republicans who control the state legislature look less interested in reforming the red flag gun law and more interested in repealing it. Do we know what exactly they are doing toward that end right now? It looks like, on the one hand, that they're just sort of wanting to review the red flag gun law in the state of Florida. But it also looks like Governor DeSantis has been making it pretty explicit that he wants it to go away. What's your sense?
Yeah, I'm not. I mean, it seems like one of these recurring issues that's definitely come up in our reporting in response even to our story that, you know, these injunctions and the red flag law, people feel like they infringe on their, you know, personal liberties to have guns. So it's definitely coming up at a strange time when you have people calling for, you know, an expansion of the red flag law in these domestic violence cases, but then you have DeSantis trying to take it away.
Yeah, and we should mention this seems to be part of the governor's current big gun rights push, like granting what he calls a gun tax holiday in Florida, like the one we see for school supplies every year, right?
Yeah, it's definitely a big push. I mean, we've been seeing there, you know, there's other things they're trying to do away with, like the age restriction. So it'll definitely be interesting to see what happens because, I mean, from what we know, law enforcement likes the red flag law because it gives them that power to take those guns away. And then obviously in cases like this, it can look bad when they don't.
Right. And just in the 20 seconds we have left, do they worry that we may well see more gun homicide tragedies like the one last month in Tamarack if we do get rid of the red flag gun law in the state?
I think that domestic violence lawyers would say it's a step in the wrong direction because they want these red flag laws to actually be used in these cases, not taken away.
Shira Moulton is breaking news reporter for the South Florida Sun Sentinel. Shira, many thanks.
Thank you so much for having me.
Finally on the roundup, if you're Latino in the U.S., you've probably heard of the term No Sabo Kid. WLRN senior producer Sherilyn Cabrera certainly has.
We've heard it on TikTok.
We're No Sabo Kids. When we're embarrassed, we say we're embarazado.
I'm a No Sabo Kid, and I absolutely hate it. I'm Puerto Rican. My mom's Puerto Rican.
Can we stop making fun of No Sabo Kids?
Being a No Sabo Kid means that your Spanish is probably not perfect, or maybe you don't know the language at all. No sabo is the incorrect way to say I don't know. The correct conjugation is no sé. Latinos use the expression to shame or label others within the community because of their imperfect Spanish. It's even been used to define their connection to their culture. Soon on the South Florida Roundup, we'll discuss how Latinos have embraced the term to redefine their identity beyond speaking perfect Spanish, and the unique ways in which bilingual people in South Florida go about being fluent in two languages. But first, we want to hear from you. Have you heard the term No Sabo Kid? Do you consider yourself one? Tell us about your experience and what being a No Sabo Kid means to you. Visit WLRN.org/nosabo to share your thoughts. And we will include your stories into the upcoming segment here on the South Florida Roundup. I'm Sherilyn Cabrera in Miami.
That will do it for the South Florida Roundup. If you missed any part of the show, you can always search for the South Florida Roundup podcast in the NPR app or wherever you listen to podcasts. The show was produced by Jimena Romero with assistance from Denise Royal. Katie Munoz is our director of original live programming. Mateo Sanchez is digital director. Sergio Bustos is WLRN's vice president of news, the vice president of radio, and the show's technical supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. MJ Smith engineered today's show. Richard Ives answered the phones. I'm Tim Padgett. Have a great weekend, and thanks for listening. Gracias, merci, obrigado.
WLRN.